a VFR flight over Niagara Falls. You can still do that? What other cool sights are we missing? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We're here for our Monday chat on safety issues. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, as always, Paul.
Bob, I had the distinct pleasure of having a flight review with you when I was in the Western New York area a few weeks ago. And one of the things that surprised me about that was that we were able to fly over Niagara Falls. And I know that in this post-9/11 reality in which we live, there are a lot of restrictions on where you can take a small airplane without getting people very, very nervous. And frankly, I was kind of surprised that Niagara Falls was still open to be flown over. And I wondered if maybe we're not thinking big enough, not looking at the entire spectrum of possibilities for places we could fly to as a destination that would be as interesting as the trip getting there. Do you have any other locations that you have flown to that people might be surprised are still available in this current security environment?
Well, without question, the Hudson River VFR corridor, just outside, in the New York airspace, just along the western edge of the island of Manhattan, frankly surprises me that that is still open. Likewise, the East River corridor is still open. A few more restrictions apply over there, but these are what I think we could call fragile airspaces. We've seen what's happened to the airspace over the Grand Canyon, for example, with the enormous restrictions placed over there. In many cases, I think local politics rule, depending upon what pressures are brought to bear against the general aviation community. But this is where I certainly tip my hat to AOPA and the fine work of Phil Boyer and his staff in trying to keep these airspaces open. They do not, and of course, to any of us, represent any risk at all to people down below. But nonetheless, these are fragile airspaces, and it's something that I think that we should take advantage as long as they are open and available to us.
Well, now you fly that Hudson River corridor on a fairly regular basis, and there are, of course, some new restrictions on it since the Corey Lytle incident. What do you have to go through to plan a trip through that VFR corridor there?
Well, the Hudson River corridor, like the East River corridor, just have a skilled understanding of the sectional, the chart that applies to the terminal area chart. Forgive me that the terminal area chart that pertains to that area, and have an intimate working understanding of the chart, and then obey the chart. Go where you go, or go where you're permitted to go, and avoid where you're not permitted to go. Number one. Number two, master your radio skills. Even though we're under the Class Bravo space in the Hudson River, for example, in Class G airspace, ATC is more than eager to talk with us as we traverse that, even down low along the river surface, 500 feet above the water. So number two, be talking to ATC. And number three, I think local lore really does have a role to play. Talk to individuals who have flown that route before. Ask them either online or through forums or chat groups or in person, or come to Buffalo and take some instruction. Either way, having local knowledge goes a long way in making that trip much more safe and much more enjoyable.
Now, you have recently put into operation a fleet of new 172s that have glass panels in them. Does something like the G1000 make this a lot easier?
Yes, having traffic collision or traffic information services displayed on a large screen goes a long way in helping to identify targets that ATC very eagerly points out to us. Nothing takes the place, of course, to looking out the window and watching for other traffic. But the Hudson River corridor on a Sunday afternoon, a day in July or August or September when the skies are very clear, there are a lot of aircraft in the sky. We have helicopters traversing the river east and west, just taking people sightseeing, moving executives from Manhattan Island to the Jersey Shore, the Jersey side. There's a lot of that traffic. But to answer your question, yes, the G1000 or any display that is showing traffic is a great help.
I was thinking actually more along the lines of knowing exactly where the boundary of those corridors are.
Well, yes, that helps, but your visual references, staying over the river, for example, is almost a necessity because, you're lower than the tops of some of the buildings, depending upon where you are along the river. We have to keep in mind, though, that this is a zero-defect kind of activity. I mean, we saw what the Corey Lytle incident did to the image of general aviation, particularly in the New York area. We cannot afford a mishap. I mean, we cannot afford something that results in somebody getting hurt.
Well, we're going to talk in a moment about how these defects do still occur, maybe in a different context. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to the special feature from Aero News.
Do you feel stimulated? Hey, that's why Congress passed the Economic Stimulus Act of 2008, so loyal Americans like yourself would feel stimulated to help rev up the economy by spending money on important stuff like new Garmin avionics. We're talking potential tax incentives, bonus depreciation up to 50% in first-year cost allowances for qualified business use equipment purchases. See your tax advisor for guidance and your Garmin dealer for one whale of a stimulus package. It's almost like your patriotic duty, huh? Garmin, follow the leader.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We're talking today about some of the restrictions we face as flyers. Bob, I want to talk a little bit about this presidential election season. There are going to be a lot of TFRs in effect. Not only, I mean, now in addition to dealing with whatever surrounds President Bush wherever he goes, we're talking about what will surround both Barack Obama and John McCain and even the vice presidential candidates. If they make campaign appearances, these things can pop up. And as is often the case, sometimes their schedules don't go as planned, and these things are popping up at times different from what we first thought were going to be or what might have been originally published in a NOTAM. NOTAMs are out there. We have flight service to brief us. Why do we still keep reading about pilots who bust TFRs?
That's a frustrating question, and it continues to happen, particularly when it is so easy to avoid them. I think anybody who is flying in the national airspace system today, anywhere near where candidates are likely to appear, or near large metropolitan areas, or for that matter, anywhere, we need to be in constant touch with ATC. I think that goes without saying. Anytime we do training flights in our own backyard, we're contacting ATC for VFR flight following. That's perhaps their first and best defense in terms of immediacy. ATC is not going to allow you, under flight following conditions, if they're talking with you, to enter or penetrate a restricted airspace or airspace NOTAM to be restricted. Number two, we've all seen vast improvements in our flight service station system. Without going into that in any great detail, Lockheed Martin is doing a pretty credible job in providing us a responsive system. So an adequate or complete pre-briefing with a flight service station briefer is also an essential element of any kind of flying today in the national airspace system. Number three, online, we have graphic TFRs now being displayed graphically online that are readily accessible to all pilots. So between those three, ATC, flight service station and stations, and self-briefing on the internet, we should have a pretty good understanding of where these TFRs are popping up.
Well, you've mentioned a couple of things that caught my interest. One was I have not heard an awful lot lately about Lockheed Martin and continued problems with flight service, even from AOPA. Has that system, to a great extent, straightened itself out?
To a great extent, it has. I just completed a survey of pilots, and we had some 1,100 responses coming back over the summer to is flight service better than, same as, or worse than before. And it's moving in a very good direction. I have an article coming up in the October issue of IFR magazine, and when you read that article, you'll see that for the most part, it's coming back to the pre-takeover days, and that service I found personally is also being very responsive, so that's improving.
You know, in terms of technology and just adapting to change, I hate to even bring this up, but there is a segment of the pilot community which I think may be exemplified by the guys who fly without radios at busy airports, who just don't want to take that step into whatever the new technology or new procedures are. Is there a group of pilots, Bob, that just shouldn't be flying in the national airspace system?
No, I don't think I would go that far. I like many of us, believe in the freedom of flight. And the individual who wants to fly his J3 Cub, her J3 Cub, without a radio or a light sport aircraft, without having to talk on the radio, there's a role for and a place for these aircraft. But it just begs the question in terms of having the skills to simply look out the window, watch for other traffic. I don't want to see us get into a system that is so regulated that absolutely requires us all to have radios on board our airplane. But on the other hand, if we're going to fly near busy airspace, up close or under or over Class Charlie airspace or Class Delta airspace, then it really is incumbent upon us to have radio communication underway. It's such an easy solution today. It's not expensive. We can put a handheld radio on an ultralight or a light sport aircraft or a J3 Cub, snap it to a set of earphones, and we're in touch with ATC. I think anything that enhances the safety ought to certainly be voluntarily complied with. Going to the regulatory route of making us all have radios, yeah, it's probably a good idea, but it seems to chafe at the freedoms on the other end.
Well, you know, I also hear pilots who have been flying for decades who complain that all the technology has relieved us of the need to be good pilots in some cases. Well, here's a situation where if you're going to fly in the area of a TFR, you've got to back that up with action and proof and actually demonstrate that you do have those, pilotage skills.
Well, you certainly do, because the penalties are great. Not necessarily the penalty of an accident, but the penalty of a violation. The FAA is enforcing very strictly now penetrations of restricted airspace. We know that from the experiences down at the Washington ATIS. So, I mean, if it's like gambling, you can do it, but you got to be able to afford the losses if, in fact, you lose.
Well, Bob, as always, we appreciate your insights, and thanks for joining us. We'll catch you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul. My pleasure.
You can find more of Bob Miller's thoughts in his monthly newsletter, Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, at overtheairwaves.com. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.